I hear there's rumors on the internets.
Hello from London, Bratislava and Magdeburg. My name is Mark.
And I'm David, and you're listening to the Check Your Facts podcast. As Mark likes to say, a little podcast about media, journalism and everything related with us, the hosts. Hello. How are you, Mark?
Oh, I'm fine. And I'm very happy because the last episode was like retweeted by some guy from New York Times, the one with Cat. So, yeah, maybe it's not so little anymore.
Oh, okay. So maybe we are growing. So the biggest news of the day when we are recording this episode is Twitter went from 140 to 280. I believe by the time this episode is out there, like, no one remembers.
Yeah, it's going to be 2 weeks or so, but I haven't tweeted anything more than 140 characters, I have to say.
Like, when the news came out, I was like, my only thought was, like, I have to tweet, like, more than 40 characters. Like, that was, like, my only thought.
Yeah, I don't know. It was kind of the signature move of Twitter to have this very small character number. But as it's always with news and with new inventions and with development, in the first moment, everyone is like, oh, how can you do this? And how can you change that? And just, I don't know, 3 months later, everyone is, what the fuck? I don't care. it's just normal now. So I bet in like 3 or 4 months, nobody's talking about it anymore.
Yes, and there's like no bridge coming up to me to talk, like to invite our guest to the podcast. So I just go straight.
Oh, she's on Twitter.
She is on Twitter. You have to you better follow her because she's tweeting a lot, and she's tweeting many good not only thoughts but like great links to articles. I basically like to click through to because those are the first times I see those articles. So with that being said, I would like to welcome Federica Cherubini to the podcast. I hope I'm pronounced it right.
Yes, it's right. Hello.
Hello.
So you're joining us from London, but the name suggests that you're not a Londoner.
I'm not British. No, I'm not. I'm Italian. And I've been in London for 3 years now.
Wow, but your English is like super British. Which is nice. I love British English actually more than I love American, but I but that's like really subjective. Anyway, so how did you end up in London?
So I end up in London via Paris. So I studied and graduated in Milan, where I'm from, and then I moved to Paris. Originally, I thought I was going to stay in Paris for a month and learn French, and I ended up staying 4 years. And then I moved to London 3 years ago. I basically told my family I'll go to Paris for a month and I'll be back. That never really happened.
Well, is it like really easy for an Italian person to learn French?
Yes, it is. It's actually, I don't know, maybe not that easy. Let's say it's easier to pick up the structure of the sentence, and maybe I can guess a bit more than English, but I've studied English way more than French, so my English is better than my French.
I see. And I guess our next question, at least my next question is like, so how did you get to journalism? What did you study and where did you work before?
So I kind of thought I always wanted to be in journalism. And of course, when I was a little girl, I thought I was going to be a journalist. And then I realized I wasn't really a reporter for real. I was more interested in how journalists work. So I started focusing at university on everything about journalism. And so I did 2 dissertations, one for my undergrad on the role of news ombudsman, so the public editor. That was a time where The New York Times and a lot of US publication were focusing and investing on having public editors. And then for my master dissertation, I did a comparison between the UK press system and the Italian press system. And so I guess I've always been interested in the behind the scene of journalism, despite having studied journalism. And then during uni, I was working for a magazine in Italy. And then I moved to Paris and I found the perfect job. And I was working for the World Association of Newspapers, WANIFRA, which is an organization that represents news publishers around the world from Brazil to Singapore. And I was working for the editorial part of the operation in Paris. And I was basically, I started as an intern writing about the news industry. I remember... I don't know, articles about New York Times paywall. And when you were talking before about how quickly things move, it seems a year ago when we were talking about the New York Times paywall. So I stayed for in Paris working for WANIFRA for 4 years. I was organizing conferences about the news industry. I collaborated to a few reports. We did a report on online comment moderation where we talked to 114 publications around the world about how they were moderating online comments and all the issues there were with that. I was used to, basically I was used to go around and visit newsrooms around the world, which is still one of my favorite things. I was quite lucky to be able to do that. And then I moved to London. I worked for the Reuters Institute in Oxford, which is a research centre based in Oxford. And again, I was doing studies and reports on how the news industry works and basically how journalism is leading to its future. And then I joined Conte Nast International, where I am now, where I am head of knowledge sharing, and I joined a year ago.
Before we dig deeper into the Condé Nast thing, I would like to know, because I always thought about maybe you could move to some English-speaking country and start over with your journalism career. But then again, it's really hard, even if you're kind of fluent in the language, writing journalism as opposed to, I don't know, just talking to your friends or even doing an European podcast maybe. How hard was it, and were you like... super talented, but obviously you are when you're like 3 years in London and sound like a Londoner, but how difficult was it for you to start like in a completely different country with a different language than your mother tongue?
No, I'm not. I don't think I'm super talented. I think I was working in English in Paris too, and you know, I had studied English at school and in Milan, and I had focus a lot, but I never really use it every day for my daily life. I think I almost found writing at the beginning easier than like speaking and socializing, because I had more time to think about what I wanted to write. It's of course a different style. I'm not a reporter, so I don't know if I would be able to do the same kind of job if I was working as a journalist in a newsroom. And of course, you know, as everyone, I need editing. But I think, you know, when you spend a lot of time talking about work and thinking about journalism and the things you do every day in English, I think at some point just kind of becomes easier. I don't really remember. It was very difficult at the beginning. At some point it became easier.
I believe that, yeah. And one famous German journalist, Wolfgang Blau, joined Condé Nast some years ago now. And I think he's one of the most interesting and forward-thinking journalists in Europe right now. So if you're good enough, I bet you can make it like everywhere. Then the language barrier isn't that high or big or whatever.
Absolutely.
I told you before we started recording this podcast that I'm really interested in the stuff that, like, I'm maybe more interested in the stuff that you did before than you're doing now, but we're also like very interested in what you're doing now. But So when you worked for Van Ifra and also Reuters, as you mentioned, you traveled and did these studies. And in this podcast, we like to talk like more about the European journalism side of things. And mostly, or like mainly, if you see our studies, like you come across some media or journalism studies, they are like largely focused on like the American media houses or the UK publishing houses, sometimes maybe like Germans because they are big. But if you could tell me, like, why do you, I mean, you can correct me if I'm like wrong, but why do you think this is like in Europe? We have obviously the Reuters Institute of Journalism, which puts up a yearly study, and it's including like more and more countries. And Slovakia, there was like first time this year, which is nice. And so I'm like interested, when you did this, do you think it was like more US and like less Europe studies, or is anyone from these like institutes thinking about like, oh, we should go and do more studies in like countries which are not like represented, and maybe there are some like interesting stuff going on?
Well, yeah, absolutely. So at the Reuters Institute, not only the digital news report that you mentioned covers a lot of countries, and indeed also a lot of European but global countries, not just the US and the UK. But generally in all the studies, and I've mainly worked on three. On one was the lead author on editorial analytics, and in the other ones I contributed with other authors, and all of them were really much focused on what's happening in Europe. I think from one point of view is kind of understandable and maybe normal to be fascinated by what's happening in the US and the UK. It's easier because it's easier to get the information around, because a lot of the media and outlets that cover the industry are in English, and of course the English is the language we are speaking at the moment, so that's clearly the reason why everything is in English. But there is so much to learn from everywhere in the world, and I always found very fascinating that you know, at the end of the day there is one New York Times and a lot of small newsrooms all around the world. And to be honest, there are not as many publishers that can compete and can beat the New York Times and can do the innovation that the New York Times does, or the investment. So I think it's important to be able to look at everything. And when we did these studies at the Reuters Institute, the focus was really trying to find lessons that were applicable for all of them. Of course, there is always something to learn from the New York Times, but we also were very interested in focusing on a different level, on a regional level. But if you see now, like Nieman Lab is also starting to cover innovation in Europe. Journalism at UK has been traveling recently and covering more European news. Slice Newsroom covers the Asian market. I think more and more we are opening up to be interested in studying more closer other realities, not just the English speaking word.
You actually touched one of the things I was like exactly thinking of, like many of the like, so true. Nieman Lab, journalism.co.uk, they are doing like a great job, like covering more and more countries also outside like their like home base, which is like UK and US, and that's great. And yes, I can see in the like past few years this happening, but I just like when you were talking about you working in at Van Ifra and Reuters, I just thought back like some years ago when I visited some of the conferences, and then there came these high profile people from you know, across the Atlantic, and they were talking about like how they do what they do, but they never like not never, that's like this untrue, but like I was just thinking, like, what can I draw, take from this? Because this was, everything was like, okay, so this will be expensive. This will be for, like, I'll need, like, many graphics people. So that's why I asked the question, actually.
Yeah, well, for the editorial analytics report that I wrote with Rasmus Kleist-Nielsen, who's the director of the Reuters Institute, we interviewed publication in Slovakia, Poland, the Netherlands, Germany, France. Italy. We really tried to move away from the sole English language perspective. And I thought it was really interesting. And to be honest, one of the interesting examples from the editorial analytics was from Germany and from Die Welt and what they had developed. So, you know, it's not just about the US and the UK. There is much more around.
So you mentioned the study that you co-authored about the analytics. What do you think was like? I've read most of it. It's like I believe 40 pages long. It's not like too long, and it's nicely structured. Yeah, it is true that you touched on the analytics in different countries. And when like looking back, what do you think was like the most fascinating like thing that you found out?
I really enjoyed doing that, and it was February 2016 when we published it. So it feels like a long time ago, for how fast our industry moves. I think what was really interesting is that back then, it was the time where we were talking more and more about editorial analytics. So the analytics had moved from the marketing department into the newsroom. It was a time where more and more role like audience development editor, growth editors were starting to emerge and be quoted more and more. And I think what was interesting is that we managed through these interviews to go beyond of the concept of, you know, analytics means like, and looking at analytics just means having big screens around a newsroom and like staring at a screen with big numbers going up and down. And so I think one of the things that we noticed at the time was how and to what degree different newsrooms were getting more sophisticated about it. And I think we learned a few lessons, and that, you know, first of all, even those who are doing and or dealing with analytics very well, they're not doing perfectly. Analytics and data generally is not perfect. And I think we moved away from that a bit now, but at the time it was still a bit of skepticism about, you know, looking at the data and looking at the numbers is kind of a bad thing because we don't want to replace editorial judgment. And I think it was really interesting because a lot of this conversation it emerged that it's nothing to do with that. And so, for example, good analytics in a newsroom, we noticed were about tailoring the analytics to the editorial priorities and organizational imperatives of the newsroom. So it's not just what's the numbers, but why is that number interesting? So what are you trying to achieve? And because of that, what the metric that tells you more about that? So for example, if you, and that's also, of course, linked to what is your business model. Like, are you trying to get reach because you're based on digital advertising? Are you a subscription business? And then probably your most important metric is a conversion rate or the bounce rate or how many people come back to your site. And if you want to look at loyalty. So I think we, especially like almost two years from when we wrote the study, that has evolved a lot. But still, I think it's still important to remember that, you know, not all the metrics are the same and not all the metrics tell the same story. And then we also noticed that there were two kind of ways of looking at analytics. One was used to inform short-term strategy. So yes, of course, like monitoring Chartbeat or any other tool that tells you what's working well and moving things around on the homepage and making sure that your stories actually reach the audience you have written them for. But also analytics can inform the long-term strategy of a newsroom and inform an effective use of resources and development of new editorial tools. And actually they can help you understand if you've written a very important story you're very proud of, but that story is not reaching your audience, what can you do better to make that story reach their audience? And I think in the evolution of the use of analytics that we've seen in so far, I think one of the things we found most interesting was that analytics need to be able to provide actionable information. You know, it was a time, 2016, where it was kind of becoming used to for journalists around the newsroom to receive a morning email that said, this was a traffic of the day before, performance about this and that. But, you know, how many were actually moving forward? Like, once you know that article performed really well and you have a very high number, what does that tell you? Like, how do you benchmark? You know, how good are we in measuring across device? How much are we mixing apples and oranges and talking about different metrics that means different things? So I think the very fascinating thing about the study was learning about the degree of sophistication in the use of analytics and how we were moving from resistance from the journalists to curiosity about really using them to make the best of it. And I think if I can suggest, if anyone is interested in reading more about analytics, Chris Moran, who was the audience editor at The Guardian and now a special project editor at The Guardian, wrote a lot on analytics. And recently, a few months ago, there was a piece from Franklin Foers on called When Silicon Valley Took Over Journalism, who's very critical about the impact of Silicon Valley and especially of this like data-led culture on what was happening to journalism. Chris Moran wrote a very interesting rebuttal to that, saying, you know, you can never say, oh, you know, it wasn't the data that made me do that. You can never take the data aside from the editorial judgment. And I think the most important thing is learning to be data informed rather than data led.
That sounds really like, yeah, I agree. It's like what you mentioned is one of the things we still struggle and like are thinking about, like what are the like analytics that like people should be looking at, and like is it enough to just give them data, or obviously it's not, but like how to make understand like which data is useful for whom in the newsroom, and actually not only in the newsroom but also in the other departments of the, I would say the whole company, the publishing house, which actually leads me to the role you are doing now at Condé Nast, which stands like in your Twitter bio, like you're the head of knowledge sharing. When I was looking for more information on this mysterious title, I found a little bit more detailed bio on Journalism Festival site, where I believe you were one of the speakers last year, this year.
Yes.
This year. And that said, like, you are like bringing the knowledge not only across the editorial, but also like the business side of things, and not only like in your like headquarter, but all over like the different divisions. So like, could you elaborate on that?
Yes. I'll start with telling you more about Condé Nast International. So as I mentioned, I joined Condé Nast International over a year ago. And you mentioned before Wolfgang Blau, who's now the president of Condé Nast International. And I joined as part of his team, based in the headquarters in London. So Condé Nast International is the sister company of Condé Nast US. And we oversee 11 wholly owned companies around the world. So Mexico and Latin America, Spain, Germany, France, Italy, Russia, China, Taiwan, Japan, and India. I hope I got them all. And so, of course, if you think about the needs of the print business before, there wasn't very much of the need of cooperation. And of course, all the additions. So across all these countries, we have a portfolio of very powerful magazines. We have Vogue and GQ, Vanity Fair, Condé Nast Traveler, Wired, Architectural Digest. And before you know, these editions and all these companies were kind of living in a bit of a siloed ways, and each country was, and each operation was unique to each country and worked amazingly well in the past. Of course, with the drivers of change behind changes in technology and digital landscape, we've started to rethink the way of contract distribution work and the internal organizational model of the company, which is a company with an incredible story. You know, Condé Nast comes from Condé Montrose Nast, who bought Vogue in 1909. And then in around 1960s was bought by the Newhouse family, still a family-owned business. British Vogue launched in beginning of 1916, I think, and a few years later in France. So it's an amazing portfolio, very rich, covering so many different regions from, again, Mexico to China. And so our team in the headquarters in London works across all these 11 different markets, across publications and across departments and area. In my role specifically, I am part of the strategy and research team, and I work as a bridge, basically. So I connect the dots between a lot of the things we're doing. I try to harness success stories and share best practice, put people in touch with each other when they're working on similar project. And it's a lot of, let's say, community building, internal community building. Everyone works in data across the company. It's part of the Condé Nast International data community, and they shared best practice, they share advice. They are support group, they are a real network. And, you know, of course, all these publications are unique in the way they are to each market. And Vogue in China, Vogue in France, Vogue in Italy, Vogue in Mexico, they have different stories, they have a different audience, but at the same time they share, of course, a very powerful and meaningful brand, and they need to remain unique, but there is always lessons and things to be learned by sharing and by knowing what are we doing, what everyone is doing. So my role is really trying to connect and bridge all these different projects and things and enable knowledge sharing, really. And so I work with editorial teams, I work with the commercial teams, with the data insight team, with the engineering team, with product, and really trying to make sure that we are aligned, that we all know. You know, it's a very big company, so even know who's who and what we're working on, it's not that obvious. we cover so many different time zones that there is not one time during the day where everyone is awake at the same time.
How do you get over the language barriers, or is your main language English?
Well, every country publishes in their own language, almost every country. The official language, you know, we work in is English. But at the same time, we have a very international team in London. We all speak multiple languages. The team comes from all over the world, and you know, it's challenging when a lot of people need to work in their known native language. But as we were saying before, I think, you know, all these challenges are overcome by the fact that everyone wants to know more. Everyone wants to learn more about what the others are doing. And English, or not being super fluent, cannot be a barrier. I think generally everyone... you know, it's just a language, really.
Okay, for me, that sounds a bit like the optimal state, I have to say, that everyone wants to know what the others are doing, and everyone wants to learn and so on, because I experienced, especially in companies when they work with, like, let's say, newspapers or old media, radio, TV, like linear media, they want to do their stuff, and if there comes something new, internet, whatever, they actually don't want to learn or want to keep doing what they're doing. So are there any struggles like these at Condé Nast, or are you like the
yeah,
most
no,
perfect
I'm not
in the
I'm not describing a golden word. Of course, there are many challenges, and of course, it is difficult. And of course, you know, being willing to learn and to know what's happening doesn't mean that everyone every time is perfectly aligned on the same things. I think, you know, there is a challenge of trying to put together so many different landscape and so many different conversation. You know, when we talk about Facebook, it's not really the most relevant thing when we think about China. So there are many differences, and of course that's important. And yes, as you said, changing whether it is about changing workflow or changing tools, everyone is used to do the things you're doing. So I think, you know, at the same time, you need to find a compromise, and you know, we're using Slack across all the markets to have one place where we can all talk to each other and have conversation, and be in one place. You know, you cannot try to be all in touch and then use 11 different tools. So there is some compromise to do. And of course, you know, journalists have their own scoop and they have their own habits. So not everyone is super happy to share everything. But I think generally the mindset is that we are a very powerful network. Sometimes I think about what BuzzFeed is doing and expanding all over the world and building a network. And we have the network. We just need to make sure we can make it stronger and make it more powerful by being more joined up and finding a good balance between global and local. My personal approach to that is, for example, when we roll out Slack, I am conscious that many other teams in other countries maybe were using a different tool. So, you know, I think as every kind of innovation and every kind of change needs to be mindful and respectful of how things are changing and how impact existing workflow and existing realities. But at the same time, you know, you need to find a way to make it work for everyone.
So when I was when you said, when I was reading about your Twitter like the profile, what you do, the knowledge sharing, and what really struck me was that you're like doing the knowledge sharing across editorial and also business side of the things. So the basic formula for newspapers, for media, for a long time has been like content needs to stand apart from the business side of things. You shouldn't even be talking together, but so what's your approach on this? Because I see this happening a lot out there.
I didn't mean that I bridge the work that editorial and commercial do specifically. It's more than I work across commercial teams, and I work across the commercial community and then the editorial community. So it's not just about, you know, of course, those distinctions stand and here too, and the editorial teams, it's one thing, and the commercial teams another. But I personally work across different areas to have picture as complete as possible of what we're working on and what we're doing.
That actually wasn't a criticism.
No, I understand.
Maybe I did not express myself in the best way. So for example, my point was the editorial is. I'll say like what's happening over here at my newsroom in Slovakia. So the editorial has like a lot of statistics. They are using like many analytical tools. They are finding out stuff, like what works, what's the best way to distribute the articles and like all the content we are producing, how to attract like more like people for like who are paying for news, because we have a paywall. But we are like this publishing house is also like trying to build up a native advertising unit, And for example, I would say like they are not maybe getting all the know-how that the guys at the editorial have, and this is also maybe the same for I would say maybe our marketing and like vice versa.
Yeah, so I think specifically I try to connect people that work in branded content, for example, internationally, so that who works in branded content in the UK can learn from campaigns we did in France or somewhere else. Of course, I don't do all this work alone. I just work as a support for many other people and with many other people in the company. And then editorial teams, for example, in London is different because in the central team that I mentioned before, I am part of, we have an editorial team, which is Vogue International, which works across the 11 editions of Vogue. And so they share, for example, best practice and insight that what's working in different areas. We're looking at social storytelling. We have a Snapchat team that works in London with teams in Paris and in London, because we have a Snapchat Discover on British Vogue and Vogue Paris. So it's more connecting teams that do similar jobs across countries than just trying to bridge or share lesson between editorial and commercial. I think generally we're trying to be more aware of what's happening in the business and in the industry, but that doesn't specifically mean, overcoming the usual barriers that editorial independence that we have and commercial.
So let me get back to your tools you're using. You said you're using Slack, and David and I are both at the Slack community, which was actually kind of the reason for starting this podcast back in the days in January with Hendrik.
I believe Federica is also part of it.
Journalist Rocks. Yeah. Yes, okay. I am part of it. Yes. Yeah,
as you know, there are so many people on there, you lose sight. but it got a bit like silent there, but I believe in a company like Condé Nast, there are way more people and it can be crowded and chaotic and whatnot and noisy.
Can be noisy,
how yes. Do you still like get to the point in every channel and with every employee and with everyone on Slack so that it's not like a big chat room with GIFs and smileys and whatsoever?
I think sometimes I'm a bit of like a Slack police, so I tried. I think, you know, Slack is a place for emoji and GIFs and nice and fun conversation, but it's also a very powerful tool that lets you communicate and have discussions around topics and across multiple areas. I think it's important. We have naming convention for the different channels so that you can understand what the channel is about. So a clear description of what's the purpose of the channel, so that if you want to join the channel or not, you clearly know why and what's the conversation and why should you be interested. I think, you know, Slack has become really good in terms of, you know, you can customize notification, you can mute channels, you can have notification only for specific keywords. I think making sure that conversation remains appropriate and on topic. Suddenly in the team channel, there is, I don't know, an interesting link shared, and then the conversation kind of goes and takes another route, and a colleague started to discuss about something else, then, you know, why not? You can jump in and say, okay, you can take this conversation to a different channel. Maybe it's becoming too specific, and it can go into the team channel for the engineering or for the editorial teams. I think, you know, we have kind of clear rules of how we use the mentioned channel so that you're not triggering notifications all the time. I think as every communal space, you have to be mindful, you know, You wouldn't invite people over for dinner and start shouting in the kitchen with everyone at the same time because that will become unbearable. Digital tools are more difficult to have the perception that everyone is standing in the same kitchen. But it's kind of the same thing. And, you know, I think I talk about from the perspective of using and leaving on digital tools. But I don't believe there is one magic tool that will like solve anything. I think everything is about how you use it and the use you make of it. And people are what makes this tool and the way you use them. And so, yes, Slack can be noisy. So I think it's always useful to remember that. And yeah, sometimes I jump in and I just give suggestions. And but it can also improve workflows a lot, and especially working across 11 countries, it can help, you know, everyone. There is always someone awake that can jump in and help a colleague troubleshooting something. So I think it's still powerful.
Is it compulsory for all team members at Conde Nast, or just the team leaders, or
no? We haven't rolled it out completely. We're still implementing it. So I don't think, you know, that's another challenge, is how you define what goes on Slack and what goes on email. I think it's a mix of like best practice and usage, and trying to understand what works best for everyone. I believe there is no point in writing a message on Slack and then having to send an email saying, oh, I sent you a message on Slack. yeah. But, you know, that gets more and more with the use, with the usage. It's not compulsory. I think it's just useful sometimes.
Yep, because I always think about how you can optimize knowledge transfer and knowledge sharing and so on. And I see it in the company where I'm working, the public and radio and TV and online station, and everyone is using everything. And if he said or she said, I send you this, I don't know if it's on Facebook Messenger, Slack, email, or another tool or a different tool, or and so on. And I find it really hard, and I try to like implement all these stuff as well, but I'm not like head of knowledge sharing or something. We don't have this position. So I bet it's a good, very good idea to have such a person, but I also bet that it's
one of the most hardest jobs. It doesn't mean I know everything.
No, but I think it's one of the really hardest jobs, because you have to bring all people together, and I'm really interested in how that works. Do you have like theories in your background that you've read?
No, I think I am generally very interested in a lot of those roles in the newsroom and in news organization that are bridging something. So, you know, sometimes it's just about being a translator, but not of languages. It's a translator of ways of working, a translator of different mindset. You know, a lot of the transformation going from print to digital is about digital mindset and cultural change. And that's tough, adapting and changing and being prepared of all the changes that sometimes are overwhelming, where everyone is super busy doing the job. It is overwhelming and it is a lot. But I think what I really like about my job is I get to talk to so many people. They're doing amazing work around the world, and trying to translate, again, not specifically a different language, but translate different ways of doing things. So currently I am taking an online course on product management for journalists, and organized by the Knight Centers for the Americas. And it's really interesting and it's fascinating if you think how the role of product managers are now getting into the newsroom, and how it's important to bridge the ways of working that the engineering team or the product team has compared to the editorial teams. And if you look around, more and more of those roles are emerging. The Washington Post announced a few months ago that introduced three new roles that are meant to standardize digital responsibilities around the newsroom. And if you look at those titles, one is like operation editor, product editor, project editor, and all these roles are in the newsrooms. The Financial Times has someone, Robin Kwong, who is a head of digital delivery, and it's bridging product management and is bringing product management and design thinking into the newsroom. So I think more and more there will be roles that are supposed to help facilitate the work across different teams. You know, it's nothing new. We were a few years ago the interactive developer, the journalist who can code, and now all of these skills are less exotic, and we're more used to that. So I'm always been very interested in all of this that happens, you know, in between things and in between boundaries. I am one in London. I'm one of the co-organizers of Hackers London. And Hackers London is a community. It's a chapter of the global movement of hackers. And the aim of the organization is bringing hacks, journalists and hackers, developers, technologies together to talk about journalism, to talk about the things to do. And, you know, a few years ago, it was really rare, and you didn't really have a lot of developers sitting in the newsroom. It's getting more and more common. It's not everywhere, of course. So I think I find particularly fascinating, as part also of my job, but there's so many other roles, those roles that don't really fit in one box or in the other, but they're meant to make collaboration better and communication better.
Okay. But I have to say, you're not the first person on the podcast who was just visiting almost every newsroom in the world or something like that. But especially for you, I think it's kind of hard, or I suppose it's kind of hard because you see all the like best practices, but how hard is it like to implement only the best, and how hard is it to not like lose track of what you've seen there and what you could implement there, but you cannot implement it like right away because it needs time? I believe that's a really hard job to do.
It is. And also, you know, not every lesson works for everywhere. So I think, and it's more about enabling teams to choose what to do. You know, I'm not mandating anything. I think the team in London is supporting and helping and informing and contributing to things that we're doing across the entire business. And I think, you know, I take one thing at a time. I try to create guides and best practice and writing and send useful links. A lot of these things are already out there. We do monthly calls with different communities around the company, so where they tell their own stories, they tell their own case studies, which can be applicable to one country, two countries, 11 countries. Not everything works everywhere. So then I do internal conferences. So I make sure that we decide and we try to make the best out of the time we spend in person and how we continue the conversation online. And for that, again, Slack is quite important. It is a lot and it is overwhelming. Imagine that each of these departments I mentioned before have full teams who work in support of the local teams all the time. So it's not just out to one person or a small group of people to keep up with everything. I personally have a lot of notebooks and take a lot of notes. I have a Trello board
for Trello
myself.
Board, so not like a notebook.
I also have a notebook, a paper notebook.
Okay.
I really love stationery, funny enough, despite working for a digital company. but I have my own Trello board, so I keep track of the different projects and, you know, a lot of to-do lists, as everyone else. I try to prioritize and get to the things that are most important, and try to keep an eye on projects that are more long-term, I think.
So, okay. So I guess I have to be the bad guy again because we're nearing our time when we have to end.
You're always the bad guy.
I'm sorry, but we always promise to bring the guest back. So I would actually love to talk more about Hacks and Hackers in London, and also like the tools you are using, but maybe another time. But
yes,
but thank you definitely so much for coming to the podcast and talking to us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And yes, everyone listening, if you're not already subscribed to this podcast, please do so. You can follow us everywhere, Apple Podcasts, on Mark managed to put us on Google Play Podcast as well.
Yes, magic.
All the links are out there. Follow us on Twitter. And I don't know what else to say, Mark.
Actually, we talked about the Niemann Lab and journalism.co.uk. There is one episode where we have two guests in one episode who are from Niemann Lab and journalism.co.uk. We will link that, or you find it on SoundCloud and iTunes as well. That's very worth listening, like every episode is worth listening. So please subscribe, and because always kind of keeps forgetting it, because I always say it, please guys, don't forget to always check your facts.
Thank you, Federica, for coming to the podcast. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you very much.